Welcome to the Cordwainers In Their Shoes podcast. My name is Katie Greenier and I'm Creative Talent and Network Director at Pentland Brands. Cordwainers are shoemakers, and today the worshipful company of Cordwainers looks to promote footwear design and entrepreneurship in both education and the fashion industry. To celebrate the company's 750th anniversary, we've brought back our podcast for season two to explore what it's like to walk in the shoes of those who have made them. Today, I'm in the recording studio with Georgina Goodman. I've known Georgina for quite a while, but I've known her work and reputation even longer. Georgina is a footwear style icon, an entrepreneur, a boss babe. She is straight talking and tenacious. Her footwear is discreetly luxurious, and she possesses an extraordinary attention to detail. Georgina and I are both Cordwainers, members of the Ancient City of London Livery Company, which has been supporting shoemakers for the past 750 years. Hey, Georgina.
Hello.
So, Georgina is looking beautiful in patchwork denim and beautiful heavy beaded necklace. And it is absolute delight to see her because I haven't actually seen her for a while. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in two places. I was born in Hassock, Sussex, and then I moved to Essex when I was like maybe 9 or 10. So I remember sort of happy picnics on the beach, and I also remember sort of making camps and running around in fields in Essex. So I've had sort of, you know, landlocked and seaside growing up. So I don't define myself as an Essex girl, but I do feel sort of a pull and a link to Essex more than I do Sussex.
Well, I'm an Essex girl, so I actually do define myself as an Essex girl. I'm loving that you're a fellow Essexer.
Yes.
So what did your parents do?
When I was growing up, my mum was what was then defined as a housewife, but she had trained as a hairdresser, and she was always very creative and maintained an amazing garden. So she was a professional kind of like housewife, you know, like we had an amazing garden, we had an amazing house, we had an amazing kind of everything, the ballet classes, the horse riding, just literally everything. And my dad used to get in the car or on the train every day and go to the East End of London. And he was a timber merchant, Jewish family business that he inherited from his dad. And so the reason we moved to Essex is because it was nearer to Stratford.
When did you realise that you were creative or had a gift?
I always knew that. I always knew I was challenged at school. Not really understanding why at that time, because the time I was at school, there was no kind of neurodiverse tags or dyslexia. And I realise now I am very much on the spectrum. Thank the Lords, you know, because that allows me to access my creativity in a way that is really, really quite extraordinary. I mean, when I talk about my process, people can't believe I can, you know, in my 50s, I still stay up all night. I can hyper-focus. I can design three things at the same time. I can manifest a lot. It's a bit like the elves and the shoemaker. You know, people I'm living with will go to bed and wake up in the morning and they'll be like 70 things I've designed or 200 drawings. I don't know how I do it. But anyway, that's that part. And when I was a kid, I had a horrible time at school because I couldn't read until I was 11. I couldn't retain information. I couldn't focus. I couldn't concentrate. I had trouble with noise. All of those things I understand now, which are sort of linked to the symptoms of ADHD. I basically just kind of bottled it and was really unhappy. Left school at 16.
Wow.
Worked in a jean shop.
So how did you go from jean shop?
Yeah.
What happened to...
Okay, so but I was always obsessed with going to St. Martin's, okay? So I left school with no qualifications. I think I had an art grade C O-level and I had a CSE French, you know, which grade 5 or something, which means you can't speak French, you can't understand it, you just turned up. So I...
Did you feel like you'd done well?
No. I felt like I couldn't talk about school. I just had to, I've got to get out there. But I always loved fashion. I mean, I used to dress my dolls. I used to design clothes. I mean, every single week I was designing clothes to go to the youth club with my friend Sarah Scott and me and Sarah, who I'm still friends with. And Sarah Scott and I used to be like, well, we were fashion obsessed. We'd do things like buy two sweatshirts and chop them up, and she'd have half and I'd have half, and we'd stitch them back together. And I mean, like, we were way ahead of our time. And then, yeah, so that sort of styling element of kind of like, you know, repurposing clothes. We both had sewing machines, but I'd go round to her house and we'd sort of sew on a Thursday night to go to youth club on a Friday. So Friday was a big day for me. And she got into a fashion course, but I didn't get into a fashion course because I didn't have the qualifications. So I had to sort of go off and get other qualifications. So while I was working at the shop, which I was really, I loved actually working at the shop because I met someone who I fell in love with, my boyfriend, Alexis, and he introduced me to music and all sorts of naughty stuff and that I hadn't sort of been into before, like going out late. And I was only 16, so I was still on a curfew, really. And we became friends with some people who were at St. Martin's. So there's a whole sort of Essex crew that used to get on the train, go up to London every day. And they were like the trendy fashion people. And I was like, I really want to be one of those. So I thought, okay, so my main aim now is to get onto a BA. So I went and did a tech course at Southend College of Technology. And I trained for 2 years in technical fashion. So pattern cutting, making, everything from everything that's the back end of fashion, the back end of design. But of course, I couldn't help but sort of design collections and enter competitions. And I started to meet people from that course, the teachers who had gone to St. Martin's or who knew people, and they started introducing me. And then I started introducing me in a different, as a model, actually. So I started modelling in London. I'd go up to London, be on shoots, so see the world. And I was like, oh, this is fashion. Oh my God, I really want to be in this world. And I started making connections. And then I applied for St. Martin's and I didn't get in. I thought my whole life was over. And so, but because of these connections that I've made during this sort of time when I was modelling or on a shoot or assisting someone, mostly my teachers, I actually met someone who had a design label, and I started working for them. They're called The Cloth. They were really famous at that time, and they sold in Harrods and Harvey Nichols and Liberty's, and Lynn Franks was their PR. And it was like I was literally thrown in as the seamstress and in-house designer into this world. It was like catapulted to a really high level. So I was going to parties, I was meeting people. I was like literally connected within months. And I wasn't shy to talk to people because you don't really know what's cool and what's not cool. You just sort of go, oh, that's amazing, you're amazing. And I just made all those connections. So making connections, I think, is kind of key.
Well, you're good at talking to people, I think, and owning a room. You know, you come in and you have charisma and you own a room. And so sometimes those other things are just, you know, they don't matter.
Yeah. I mean, I think also I could work hard. So I would work all night. And so they'd come in the morning and all the patterns would be made, or a whole collection would be made. Or it was like having three people. I had a tremendous amount of energy as well. So I think I also bring that to any situation, especially a work situation. Like, I'm more energetic than my assistants and they're exhausted at 7 o'clock. And I'm like, 7 o'clock, come on, let's go. Woo! And that's a gift, but it's also, I can't switch off either.
It's an addiction, isn't it?
Yeah.
So then what happened? So you're then working for The Cloth.
Yeah.
You're their pixie in the back room.
Yeah.
You're also, you have this charisma and a great network. What happened then?
Okay, so again, I was at a club and I had my hair shaved. I decided
skinhead.
So I was a total skinhead, and it was like a look. I was like busting a look for a minute, and so I was out at this club, and this girl comes up and she goes, "Like your hair," and I was like, "Thanks." And she also had a skinhead. She goes, "Yeah, I'm doing a shoot actually." And she doesn't talk like that. She's now one of my best friends. I'll tell you who it is in a minute. And I was like, and I knew exactly who it was. I was like, and I probably had cut my hair to kind of copy her, Karen Franklin, who was the fashion editor of ID magazine. And so there we were at some sort of like dodgy divey club in Soho, like underground at some kind of like sweaty night box club, you know, dancing away like, yeah, I like your hair. Yeah, I like yours. And I ended up on a shoot for ID magazine called Disco Skins. And of course, I sort of networked my way around the whole room, and sort of said, I'd love to work at ID. And within kind of 2 months, I'd sort of left the cloth and said, I'm really sorry, I want to be a fashion stylist, so I'm going to go to ID. Now, the job that I was offered was not assistant stylist or anything in that department. It was advertising executive, but it was my way in to magazines. Yeah. So I just took that job, absolutely rubbish at it, absolutely crap at sort of getting people to buy stuff they don't need or they don't want. Can't do it. Like, I'm really good at selling in a shop shoes or whatever it is, but selling advertising is a very particular thing, and I wasn't so good at it, but I was good at all the rest of the stuff. So,
and they then saw that?
Yeah. And so I would...
Well, you probably were working so hard to make them see that you were good at all the other stuff.
Absolutely. So you come in a different outfit, everything. They go, oh, I love that. Let's photograph that. Oh, we need a T-shirt shoot. George, can you, whip your clothes off and get you... So I was the kind of... Every time they needed someone to kind of...
You were there.
Do something. I'll do it.
So did you then become a journalist?
No, I wouldn't say journalist, because I was a stylist, and then I went to work with Simon Foxton as his assistant, who was sort of is still one of my favourite stylists, actually. But that was mostly menswear that he did. But I assisted him for a while, and then because I'd had such a close friendship or relationship with Karen, and such a close-knit family, we call it the ID family, such a close-knit family. Like, we're all still in contact with each other, and if you've worked at ID, you're sort of like, you've got these kind of spider web senses everywhere. And she was then worked on the clothes show. So I then started working on the clothes show. And so I was a researcher stylist on the clothes show. But yeah, you do have to write things or research in a journalistic way. So create a story, whether that be kind of like polka dot swimwear or, I don't know, like silly stories that we had to come up with. But then I worked at Elle magazine, which was more writing, which was more about... I worked in the features department.
What made you leave ID? Because it seems like you're in the perfect team.
I didn't have the job I wanted at ID.
Okay.
I didn't have the job I wanted because I was the advertising executive, and people don't really move around. The jobs didn't move around. The two people that were there, and they weren't going anywhere. So it was quite a small magazine, very, and...
I loved it.
Yeah. I mean, I love it, still love it.
You have this extraordinary sketching, drawing talent. Did all these people know that you had this? Or is it just your superpower that you didn't get out? Or didn't you know yourself?
Interestingly, I didn't know... Okay, so I didn't know I had that. I didn't know I had that, okay? But I did know I had something else, which was... I could see into the future. No, but actually I could. I could smell out a trend. I kind of knew what was coming next. It's like something you just have it. And designers need that. And I mean, I still can use that now, like, and access it now. And I think you've either got that... or you haven't. Doesn't make you a good designer or a bad designer. It's just you need someone on a team like that.
You need to know the zeitgeist.
Yeah, you need to understand the zeitgeist, and you also need to speculate on what might be next. And it's not even a thought process. It's almost like a, ooh, I know. Like, it's going to be this. Yeah, it's really useful. It's a really useful thing to have, especially when you're building collections, because you sort of know what to put in and what to leave out and what to spend money on and what not to spend money on. So it can be really useful.
So what happened to Elle?
Okay, so when I was at Elle, I mean, I wasn't a journalist, you know what I mean? There are people who are journalists who write, who are amazing, and that's their gift. And my gift is not that, okay? I mean, it really isn't. My gift is I was actually employed at Elle on the 10th anniversary issue of UK Elle to do... a set of interviews, to organise and conduct a set of interviews. I wasn't qualified to do this, but they thought, oh, she's a good person. She knows people. She can network and she can find people. And it was called Icon to Icon, okay? And the list of people that they wanted me to put together, we're talking the Dalai Lama speaks to the Pope. We're talking, I don't know, Michael Hutchins talks to Jermaine Greer. I mean, they were bonkers. But I did most of them. I put most of these people together. And I did that via, going to show my age now, facts. So like facts questions, backwards and forwards, telephone questions, getting people in the same room, you know, Michael Hutchins and Jermaine Gregg, getting them in the same room or getting them on the end of a line, and then me kind of recording it in a very kind of play and, you know, doing really stupid things. Like when I get nervous, I say really stupid things. Like I had to talk to Jermaine Greer on the telephone, and I love Jermaine Greer. Of course, it's like, I'm a feminist, you know, and then you speak to Jermaine Greer and you turn into mush because she's like talk about a powerful, amazing woman, you know, like no nonsense, absolutely won't take any gibberish, you know. And I remember asking her about this set of questions and, you know, would she be able to do this? And she said, yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, okay. And right at the end of the conversation, my editor was listening, the sub-editor there, everyone was like all around the room going, She's going to do it. And I said, thank you so much, Mr. Greer. I know. I called her Mr. Greer. She laughed. It's okay. But that's me. When I get nervous, I'll say the very thing that you're not supposed to say. So that probably would make me not
she
a great...
She thought you were...
She thought, I don't know if she thought I was joking. She knew I was nervous because she got me on the back foot anyway. So, so that's what I did at Elle. And while I was at Elle, my editor then, Nicola Giel, said to me, what are you doing here? You don't want to do this. You're not built to work in magazines. You're not a journalist. I said, I know. She goes, what do you want to do? She goes, do you know you wear a different pair of shoes every single day? And I was like, yeah, I know. I love shoes. And she said, and you've been a stylist. I said, yeah. She goes, why don't you do shoes? I said, what do you mean do shoes? She goes, you could design shoes. And I was like, what, you can actually have a job designing shoes? Because I only knew like four shoe designers. You know, it's Manolo. I don't even think there was Jimmy Choo at that time, but there was like, you know, Vivier and like the sort of four Ferragamo, you know. But I was like, what, there are actual jobs where you can design shoes? Yes, of course there are. She goes, there's a college, it's called Corbuenos. I was like, there's a college? Yeah. So anyway, within, I don't know, a month or so, and then she said to me, she actually said at the time, I know Manolo. She always wore Manolo. She goes, you should go and speak to Manolo. No, I didn't go and speak to Manolo at that time. But interestingly, I didn't need to. So I went to the college and I remember the person saying to me, well, it isn't, you know, it's a bit of a come down. You've been interviewing celebrities and doing all this, you know, going to parties. It's hard work. This is college. It's not glamorous. It's like, get your hands dirty. And I was like, oh, I can do that. But I was the oldest person there. I was 38 when I went back to college.
Wow.
Yeah, so I started that course and it was like, because I'd had such a bad experience with education and this was a BA and I would never expected, how could I get onto a BA? I haven't got any O-levels. I haven't got any qualifications. But of course, all my life skills were taken as...
Valued.
Valued, yeah. So then I started drawing. And so my portfolio was a little sketchbook full of these designs. And I said in that sketchbook that I thought Wellington boots were going to be the biggest thing in the next 20 years as a fashion item. I wasn't wrong.
No, you weren't. You weren't.
And it was like, people are like, Wellington boots? What do you mean? I went up to Hunter. I did all this research. I was like, yeah, it's Wellington boots. I know it's going to be Wellington boots. And that was like 20, yeah, I mean, being 10 years early is not a very helpful thing, but it was 10 years early, but I could see it.
But you could see it.
Yeah.
So... You then went to Cordwainers. Mm. So what happened at Cordwainers then?
So at Cordwainers, I mean, I did win lots of competitions and I did win the Cordwainers Cup. I won a couple of prizes from Cordwainers, actually. And I won a few bursaries from other places. And
that's what led you to go to the Royal College?
I got offered a place at the Royal College. I'd never applied for the Royal College. I'd never thought me being able to go to the Royal College.
How amazing.
I was offered, my external examiner was Wendy Dagworthy, who was the head of fashion then at RCA. She saw my collection. She went, we want you on the course. And I was like, oh, okay. And Sue Saunders was running the footwear course. And Sue was like, yeah, we need George on the RCA course. And I was like, well, I've got to get a job. They go, no, with a bursary. I got everything paid for, literally.
How incredible.
Here, we need you here. You know, it was like that. And so I hadn't expected to go from BA to MA. And I thought, I'm too old. Oh, I'm just going to be 42. But actually, it was amazing. It was amazing. And that's where I met Manolo, at the Royal College.
And you won the Manolo Blahnik design competition, which must have been so exciting. He did a massive call out on you, didn't he, saying you are the next best, the next biggest footwear designer. How did you feel at that time?
Well, I didn't really understand how significant him saying that was, because it was at the opening, it was a design museum opening of his retrospective, and Lisa Armstrong, very famous journalist, was sitting sort of within ear distance, or standing within ear distance. And I was coming over to say hello to Manolo. He'd invited me to his event, opening event, and I was like very excited. And sort of the seas parted, and I was like, oh, hi Manolo, you know, so lovely. Thank you for inviting me. And he goes, step aside. You know, this is the future of footwear. And it was it was like an off the cuff saying, very Manolo, if you know what he's like. He's very flamboyant and, you know, I am, you know, this is the future. And she heard, and someone else heard, and she just wrote it. And then it was like rewritten. And so amazing, really.
That was a good night, wasn't it?
Yeah. That was a really defining night for me. Yeah, a very defining moment.
So is it then you started your own label, or what happened? So what was the fallout of that amazing quote?
Okay, so I think I'd already decided to start my own label at that time. So when I left college, I mean, I realise now my experience is quite unusual.
Yeah.
I didn't understand that at the time. You don't know how, it's like I'm always trying to say to my daughter, no, that's not normal. What's happening to you is not, you know, like that's a really great opportunity. That person recognizing that's really, but you don't know that at the time. And I think also, as I can only speak for myself, actually, but I know many creative people who think they're great, okay? And they're not that great. And I know many creative people who think they're really worthless and rubbish, and like they have to keep working, they have to keep going, and you know, like you're only as good as your last collection, and all these horrible sayings that go around. But I am one of those, okay? So I think I have to work 10 times, actually I do have to work 10 times harder. I have to work 10 times harder. I have to work, I can't stop, I can't be egotistical. Sometimes it does creep in and it's never useful. And what's always served me is working really, really hard. But sometimes you don't know when to enjoy your success. And that's something I haven't enjoyed my own success at any point, because I've always thought that's not good enough. I can do better. So but at the point when I was at the Royal College and I got a lot of people approaching me. You know, people like Florian de Saint-Pierre, who's like an amazing headhunter. People, magazines doing interviews on me. I mean, it was amazing what happened. You know, Vogue wanting to do features, this person wanting to do features. You know, like six of the best, you know, the best of this year. You know, all those kind of roundup things. I was in all of those. But I didn't understand, again, how amazing that was. Anyway, I got asked to go to interview in Paris for Dior, for John Galliano. I mean, this is straight from college, you know, to work with my second favourite at the time, because McQueen was always my favourite. I have to say that. I know that you're stuck between the two camps, and McQueen was always my favourite. And then I always said, there's the only person I ever want to work with is McQueen or Galliano. And I haven't worked with Galliano. I'd still love to work with Galliano. But I went to Dior. I went to meet Delphine Arnault, who was working with John at that time. And I remember sitting in this Paris interview, and I just had Silver, my child. So I was also pregnant when I was at my last year in the RCA. So that was a bit of a challenge, having a baby and doing an MA.
Not easy at all.
No. And I just remember thinking, I don't know how I can work in Paris. I don't know if I'm this right fit. I don't know if I'm the sort of person that can, that kind of fashion person that sort of literally lives, eats and breathes the job. And
Especially if you're about to have a baby.
Well, I just had a baby, right?
Especially if you just had a baby.
And I wasn't in my... I just thought I'd done a terrible... And I got tongue-tied and I couldn't remember words, and which happens to me when I get nervous. And I thought I'd done really badly. And then when I came out of the interview, I rang up the headhunter and I said, I really haven't got the job. I mean, I just don't want that job because I just don't... I didn't get the right feeling. And they said, no, they really like you. They really want you. And I'm like, really? And so I did get offered that job. And so I sat on the train home, all the way home from Paris to London, just thinking, what's the implication? So do I work here? Do I move my whole do we move as a family here? I just had a baby. What do I do? Oh, my God, I've got to have a job. Ah. And then I got home and I said to my husband, I said, I don't really know any. I just don't know what to do. I don't know whether to take this job. It's like the best job I could be offered in footwear for me. Or, and I just said, start my own business. And he said, well, start your own business. I was like, but I don't know anything about shoes. I don't know anything about manufacturing. Like, well, we'll learn. Naive, you know, like not understanding how much work that would be. So that's what we did. That's what we did. We just started a business, like literally the next day.
So you literally have totally been offered a job in Paris. You've mm-hmm. turned it down. Mm-hmm. And now you're about to start Georgina. Mm-hmm.
With a very small child.
With a very small child. Oh my God. So
I should have taken the job thinking about it.
Well.
I should have done, really. But anyway, you know, you did live and learn.
But you did a lot very quickly.
I know.
And then you started opening stores.
Yeah.
What was that pressure like?
Beyond. Ridiculous. Like so much pressure, so much, and also so much sacrifice because I had a small child. And when I was at my first store, and like a lot of the time I could take Silver with me, babe in arms, you know, like probably taking her to last factories and not so much factories because it's so, it used to be in those days toxic. So I didn't take her on planes or I didn't take her on the big travels. But if it was a, you know, somewhere in the country, then I would take her. Meetings for sure. Refurbing of shops, definitely. She'd come to building sites with me and stuff like that. But when I actually started work, I used to go to, because I did a handmade, we're doing handmade shoes. And I did those all in collaboration with Dominic Casey. So I used to get in the car, go down to Lewis, work with Dom, and I'd stay at Dom's house and we'd work sort of 2 or 3 days and then I'd come back. And this is before we opened the shop. So to get the collection together, it was all handmade at the beginning. The concept being that you'd come into the shop, you'd see the couture items, and then we'd make them in the workshop downstairs. And that's how we started the business as a couture. We basically launched it as the only service for fashion bespoke, and it was. There isn't very many people who do that now. I mean, there's one or two, but at that time we were the only makers of female shoes, other than the male, the big ones. You know, the Lobs. You can go in there as a woman and buy a style, but they tend to be a man's style for a woman. Whereas these were women's shoes, and we also did three men's styles.
So Dominic Casey's also done a podcast.
Yeah.
And
did he talk about working with me?
I think he did.
A little bit. Yeah. It's a long time ago, though. It's a long time ago.
Well, he's remarkable as well,
yeah,
isn't he? Absolutely remarkable,
yeah,
man.
Is.
So you've got these stores. You've got this bespoke.
Yep.
What happened then?
Well, we opened... I mean, really, there was a model for our business. And to tell you the truth, the biggest money making was through consultancy. So I was the sort of biggest cash cow in our business. So I think the thing that got me is that one time I was designing sort of 18 collections a year and, you know, 4 different people. So I'd be doing 4 for this brand, 4 for that brand, 4 for us, and then 2, and then catwalks, because I always count those as different collections. And, you know, so that went on for quite a few years of me really just burning myself out. I mean, never burning out of ideas, but just burning out of energy.
Did you know you were burning out?
I didn't know. I had no idea. I literally had no idea. I didn't really have any idea till I stopped, really. And then I was like, oh my God, that's really bad. You shouldn't do that to yourself. But I think also the reason is when you're a working parent, whether you're a man, a mum or a dad, you have to split yourself in three. So you have to, you can't come home and go, oh, exhausted. You have to come home and go, yes, of course I'll read your story. Of course I'll do a bath. It's Saturday, you want to stay, you can't stay in bed when you've got a five-year-old going, should we get on the scooter or, you know, can we go and climb trees? You're like, yeah. You know, so there's a lot of that.
So you then got to work with McQueen.
I did.
How did that come about?
Okay, like everything else in my life, and I'm waiting for the next thing, the next.
And are you
to
still running all of this at the same time when you're doing this? Is this a consultancy project? How did it come about?
Consultancy project. It was a consultancy project. I'd say that really, I prioritised McQueen over my own business in a way because he was more demanding than me. You know, so and I had a team. I had amazing. You know, I had trained my design team. So my designers could design without me even being there. You know, that's a good, I think that's a good creative director. You let go and you let other people, you oversee it. You don't need to design every single thing. If you have got a good creative direction and you can put your ego on the back burner, other people can design. Also, I trained everyone to design. We all had the same hand. So you couldn't tell my drawings from Yoko's, from Rebecca's, to all the fantastic people, if I haven't mentioned any of the other people who'd worked for me. Amazing, amazing designers in their own right. They could do it without me being there. So I was freed up to go off and do McQueen. And it provided, and not just McQueen, also Cassaday, who are a big Italian company, but they really wanted me because I was doing McQueen. So when I was doing McQueen, a lot of people wanted me as well because I was doing that. I was time poor. It was showtime, I had to be there.
Yeah.
I had to be in Paris. I had to be in the factory.
Was there a highlight from this time? Or were you just...
Many, like imagine if someone said to you, okay, you can work with someone who you've looked at or you've looked at their work all of your since his first collection, since his first St. Martin's collection. Imagine me opening ID and going, oh, McQueen, or looking at magazines, because it was magazines at that time. It wasn't social media. It was like you'd wait at this news agent. Magazines are here, and you'd pour through them. Which one am I going to buy? Or I'll buy them all. You know, it was probably like £7 to buy about 20 magazines, but that was a fortune. But I'd spend half my wages on magazines. And he was always, I cut that out and I put it on there and I thought, oh my God, it's amazing. And then one day I was in Paris at my showroom and this sort of very glamorous woman walks in and she said, hello, you know, I'm the headhunter for the Gucci group. And I was like, oh, wow. And we're very interested in Georgina. And I was like, oh, ooh. Actually, they talked to BJ, my husband, about this, not because I was out doing something or other. And when he came back, he said, oh, there was a headhunter from the Gucci group who came around to have a look at the collection. They're really interested in you meeting McQueen. I was like, what? And it was literally like, you could knock me down with a feather.
Did he live up to your expectations?
Yes.
Did he surpass your expectations?
Yes.
Oh, how delightful. I always love it when people live up and surpass your expectations. I hate it when they disappoint.
I'll tell you how I got that job, though. Not only because they came in and headhunted me, but you've got to also be good as well. And I went in and met him in his office. And he said, sat down, and he was like, so can you draw? I was like, yeah, I can draw. And he just literally just pushes a piece of paper over in front of me. And he goes, go on then, show me. Show me some drawing. And...
What did you draw?
I drew a shoe. I'd prepared myself because I thought, well, if I need to draw, this has happened to me before with Jill Sander. In a Jill Sander face-to-face, she asked me to draw something when I was an intern years before and I couldn't draw and I was like frozen with fear. And I was like, right, that's never going to happen again.
This is your superpower. You literally have got under your cape and gone, got your crayons out and gone.
Maybe. Because it was never my superpower. And my superpower was like making things out of.
But this is why I asked the question, because your illustrations are amazing. And for you not to even mention them at the beginning is like, you know. And then isn't it funny that Alexander McQueen goes, can you draw?
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, I can draw.
Yeah.
So.
Because that's how I find it more easy to communicate, especially if someone doesn't speak the same language, like in Italy or in China, or you can draw something and then they know.
Totally. So Georgina Goodman, your business, your style has changed. You're like a chameleon. Is it your love to be a chameleon or the zeitgeist, or you just love variety?
I think it's really important to change and evolve. I think it's more of like evolution for me. Because if you have a look at how I design now, is very similar to how I've always designed. There's always some signatures that are, even if, no matter what I'm designing, if I'm designing a piece of jewelry or if I'm designing an object or if I'm designing whatever it is, there is a signature. And so fashion is a style, but it is also a movement. You know, so to fashion something, to swathe something around your body, it should be able to move. And I think shoes are more hard than clothing, but you can't, there are some shoes that I could have designed 25 years ago that you wouldn't know and they're still relevant now. I look at designers like Maud Frison or Vivier. You know, you can look at a Vivier shoe, it doesn't look dated. You could still put that on and wear that now. And, you know, I just think, I can design in the zeitgeist, but there's also things that I have always had in my collection. And if I was still designing collections, would still be in my collection.
Timeless staples.
Absolutely.
So do you want to talk about losing your company and the rights to your name?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's almost like something that happened. But at the time, it was something that defined me, because I defined myself by what I did, not by who I was. And I felt other people defined me. And actually, to a large extent, people do define you by what you do. And it's almost the first question that people ask you, what do you do? And I really try my hardest now never to ask someone what they do. I always say, are you having a good day today? How are you feeling? Even if I haven't met them before, or it's like quite a nice question to ask people, because it's less invasive. But as soon as people say, what do you do? Or go, oh, you lost your business, like in a horrible throwaway. Oh, you lost your business. You lost your name, didn't you? It's like, yeah, I'm really careless. I did lose my name. Or they say,
but you got it back.
Yeah, I did. We did get it back. We did. But also just like, it wouldn't have mattered if I hadn't got it back, because I am my name. So really, it's about the rights of using. But by the time I got it back, it was soiled. It was tainted. So, you know, I think I would say that it wasn't nice. You know, like, it was really not a nice experience. And it's really something that, looking back on it now, I couldn't have avoided it. It's a bit like, oh, if I hadn't done that, that wouldn't have happened. It wasn't in my control. And it wasn't like something I did wrong, or it was just the wrong investors. You know, they didn't understand. If people are going to invest in a fashion label, they can't just give it a year or 2 years. You have to give it five, because
it takes time to
actually
design.
You will lose money in 2 years. And then if you get out in 2 years, you've lost all your money. But if it's good, you will triple your money in year three, quadruple in year four, et cetera, et cetera. But you have to give it that time. And I think that because we were only at kind of, you know, we were breaking even, but I was breaking my butt because I was bringing in a lot of money into the business through consultancy. And they were like, well, we'll just get George to do more consultancy. And I said, no, I can't do more consultancy. I'm only one person. And so they said, well, okay, well, there's things we can do cheaper. We can do this, we can do that, we can do that, and we can get a new designer. So I just think I don't really know what went on or what happened. They just decided, I'll pull the plug. We've got three other businesses that we'll just put all the money into that one now. And also, I think investors do this thing as a tax loss as well. Like if you've lost 2 million quid, you can put that down you can put that on your tax form, and that's kind of useful. So maybe I was that. I really don't know, but I don't think it was because I was a bad designer or it was a terrible business. But that is the implication where people. Some people might think that, but I know that I wasn't.
I don't think that.
No.
I wouldn't even think that. I would have thought probably bad investors and people that are not supportive of the greater good. And I don't think people realise how long the shoe process is from design to make.
Also what they had. They didn't understand what they had. They didn't understand that it's not normal to be able to do what I do. You know, there are very few people that can do it.
So did you have any massive, I suppose, lessons out of that? Is there anything that you just thought, God, I'm never going to do that again? That's never going to happen. Or did you just like move on?
It's a really difficult question to ask, because if you'd asked me that 5 years ago, I'd say, well, I'm never going to do that again. I'm never going to do this. But now I just think, I don't know. I mean, you have to manifest things, right? And I think I didn't have the energy to kind of go, da-da, I'm back. And I remember actually someone said to me, you have to be back within a year or you'll never come back. And that was true. You know, like if I needed to have manifested or gone out and find investors in the first year, but I felt like I was exhausted. Spanked, you know, like it.
I bet it sounds like you were just not even having time to raise your head to even breathe, let alone to see what else was going on.
Well, I was in litigation and I wasn't able to talk about it for a year, there were certain things, certain clauses I couldn't talk about or I couldn't discuss. And then also I felt like I'd had reputational damage and I was trying to get some compensation for that.
I think when I was reading all the stuff on you again, I'd actually forgotten.
Had you?
Yeah.
That's good.
I'd actually forgotten.
I don't talk about it very much.
I think maybe you get that off your website. Because like I don't think it matters.
Well, I'm probably going to be changing my website.
Do you
know
what I mean? I just don't think it matters.
I don't think it does either, but also it is quite important when I talk to students.
Yeah, I think it's a really good bit going to almost what is the best piece of advice you've been given and what is your biggest advice you'd give to others?
Okay,
maybe?
So the best piece of advice I've ever been given that I'm not using at the moment is that when you're 90, you're not going to think, oh, I wish I'd worked every single weekend. I would take more time off. I would definitely take my weekends off. And I would try to enjoy the success I've got when I've got it. That's what I would try to do.
So that goes to the question, will you ever celebrate your success?
I think, do you know when? I don't know the answer, but what I'd love to be able to, because I did lose a lot in, I think if I'm sitting in a lovely house with a lovely garden, looking at the sea, and I'm going, oh, this is nice, isn't it? And I've paid for all of this. And that'd be really, I'd like comfort. I'd like not to have to work. That's what I'd love. That's my, oh my God, that'd be amazing.
I think it would be amazing, but I also think you've got ants in your pants and you'd get up and start doing something.
Yeah, but then I'd go and learn something. I'm always doing courses.
We'll get to that. So what would be your advice to someone that was starting their own business in footwear or accessories or in our industry?
I think the most important thing is that you have to know why you're doing it, who you're doing it for, and why it's relevant. Because there are too many brands, there's too much stuff, people don't need anything. So you have to be ethical in your design approach, as in, is this really enhancing someone's life? Is it harming the planet? And all these different questions you need to ask yourself. It's basic ethics, design ethics. You can't just do it because you want to be famous or because you think, yeah, that'd be nice. It's like a really big commitment.
What are your ambitions now for Georgina Goodman?
Well, I mean, I'm a creative and I think that I have to keep making things. I teach other people, I teach MA students, I teach on MA Fashion Artifact and MA Fashion Footwear. It's not Fashion Footwear, it's MA Footwear.
And where's that at?
At University of Arts London.
Right.
And which is part of the Cordwainers sort of, ex-Cordwainers College. And that's really important to me to be able to do that. I mean, I do work with a few footwear companies. I work with Vivo Barefoot. And not on a regular basis or anything, just doing a few kind of footwear consultancies. But actually my footwear focus has kind of changed. I think this is as a result of teaching on the MA Fashion Artifact, that I realised that I'm much more an artifact designer than a commercial footwear designer, although I'm still really good at it.
You are. I was about to say, I nearly bought a pair of your shoes yesterday, but I was going to ask you about them today.
Oh, no, you can have them. You can have some. You can have them. But I love learning. I love learning new things.
So I think this leads us nicely on to what are you learning next then?
Okay, so I've been, so interestingly.
You're in your 50s.
Yeah.
You're a forever learner. Yeah. You're a forever student.
Well, I think that for me, if I'm not learning something, I don't feel alive. If I'm not pushing myself, I'm not pushing my brain. And really, my team that I used to have was really more about technical support. And also, you know, it's really great to work with an assistant and talk to someone. But actually, it was all the things, you know, all of the computing stuff that I've never done. I'm not doing anything to do with the computer. And so I started to sort of challenge that. And then I just started to think, well, designing now is change. It's not just about drawing. It's also about 3D, you know, so you can render something, you can make it in 3D on Rhino, you can render it on Blender, you can, you know, all these different things. I'm like, I don't know how to do that. So anyway, I started to delve into it. And then I thought, actually, I'm really interested in walking into space. And I started looking at landscape architecture and the idea of being able to walk, you know, into that space. What does that space look like? Then that sort of led me into the garden, really. Sort of inspired by my mum, who'd been an amazing gardener. I'm not like, I don't know anything about plants. I don't know really anything about gardens, but I just like the idea of creating spaces.
But I think you know about scale and you know about shape and you know about...
Mm-hmm. I'm learning.
But I think as a footwear designer, they're actually part of it. And even
I don't know. It's a new, whole new thing. I found it really challenging.
And is that because it's not on your feet, or is that because it's around you?
It's because it surrounds you. It's because it surrounds you. And also, I'm challenged by the technical. So I work on a 3D program called SketchUp. Mm-hmm. And SketchUp is basically you draw things 2D, then you extrude them 3D, and then you can walk into the space and it's like, oh, that's amazing. And so I had to learn that. And now I know how to do it. It's sort of released my creativity in a different way. So that's really interesting. So I've been doing that course since September and I finish in 3 weeks.
How exciting is that? I love your energy and I love your forever student because I think it's incredible. And when I think about just your journey, do you not just think how incredible your journey has been?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I really do, actually. I really do. My daughter has started a magazine. She's an entrepreneur. It's called Plates of Meat. And
Plates of Meat.
It's got so much traction. And it's now on its fifth issue. And it's in 50 magazine shops across the world. And it's like this person's talking about it and that person's talking about it. And she's amazing. And I just think she doesn't know how amazing it is. And it's a bit like, I'm like, I can see that that's not normal, you know, and my journey has not been normal either. So
you are a cordwainer. What's the importance of being involved in the livery company?
Well, I mean, when I was at college, it was really amazing because I was supported. I didn't really understand what it was. And then Sue Saunders, sadly not with us anymore, was my teacher on MA and BA. And she actually was the person who suggested I become a cordwainer to the cordwainers. So really my link to the cordwainers is through Sue. And I'd just like to talk about Sue for a minute.
I think you should, because she's also my link to the cordwainers too.
Okay. I might cry because she was like my second mum. But Sue did more for the footwear industry than any one single person. This is a person who, any footwear person you name who's of a certain age has been through her hand.
She impacted so many young people, young footwear designers or accessory designers' lives in such an extraordinary way.
And she didn't have children, and her students were her children.
Yeah.
So for me, it was Sue. My link to the cordwainers is Sue. And I'll be forever grateful to her, but I really miss her. So yeah. When I go, I'm like, oh, Sue's not here.
Yeah, it's very strange about her, isn't it?
Really,
and I just
really
remember
strange.
Always being outside with her.
Yeah. I know.
Outside the door as well, waiting for her to come in.
Yeah.
And even it was just nice sitting with her outside.
Yeah.
And then coming in and her laugh. Her laugh was incredible.
Yeah.
I think that was a lovely, lovely thing to say. So I think we should get to the quick fire round.
Yeah, go on then. Go. Let's go.
High heels or flats?
Flats.
Fashion trend you don't get?
Get them all.
Favourite food?
Ham sandwich.
Bland. Too hot or too cold?
Ooh, no extremes.
What's the scariest thing you've ever done?
The course I'm doing now. Landscape architecture.
What's your karaoke song?
I Will Survive.
Oh, I love it. Favourite cocktail?
I don't like drinking.
Would you rather an extra arm or an extra eye?
Eye.
What's your favourite read?
Poetics of Space.
Sun or activity holiday?
Activity.
Favourite thing to draw?
Anything.
Would you rather swim to work or cycle?
Swim.
What's your guilty pleasure?
I don't have any guilt.
What? Come on.
No, I don't believe in guilt.
Messy or tidy?
Messy.
Do you enjoy building flat pack furniture?
Yes, love.
You're the first one. When are you most productive?
2 o'clock in the morning.
Do you think you'd make a good prime minister?
No, terrible.
For more information on Georgina Goodman, where should our listeners go?
Ooh, I don't know. Watch this space. I mean, I've got a website and Instagram and all that kind of thing. You can Google, you know what I mean? It's
You'll find her. Thanks so much, Georgina.
No, thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been lovely.
To walk in your shoes and to see you.
Yeah, it's always nice. It's always lovely
to see
you.
You are like a shining light.
Oh.
For more interest in Cordwainers livery, please visit our website, cordwainers.org, or our Instagram at worshipfulcordwainers. What a laugh. So lovely.
Yeah, really nice.
Done.